One.
Chris, the topic we'll be discussing today is, who is in your personal Mount Rushmore of RPG creatives?
Aw, you are, Andy.
I haven't created anything, but, yeah. but thank you.
Hello, and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rao.
Andy, it has been like a solid month or month and a half since we've recorded one of these. Like, a little peek behind the curtain is we had the con at the Ann Arbor District Library, then we recorded ahead of time, and it's just been sort of like, yeah, nothing. So I hope we can do this.
Yes. It's the way things work here at Roll for Topic headquarters is for years we talk about, like, wouldn't it be nice to record a bunch of episodes like way in advance and just be ahead of the curve. So then every 2 years, we record like one episode way in advance, and then nothing happens, and we never get ahead of the curve, like, because the next one is recorded days before.
Yeah, we immediately use the small lead we've given ourselves.
Yes. So, yeah. Okay, but here we are, Chris, and... Mm-hmm. Yes. Did you have a question you were going
to
ask me?
I did. Yeah. I wanted to know, since it has been a little bit since we've talked, just wanted to check in about like what you're reading these days.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Are you still reading that gigantic volume about H.P. Lovecraft?
I am. I just hit the halfway mark at page 800, in fact.
So yeah.
Okay. We're into, he is 31. So that's... Yeah,
when did he start writing most of the stuff that everybody knows?
He started writing the stuff most people know when he was in his late 20s, I think.
Okay.
Maybe around age 30. He wrote a ton of stuff before that, but it did not kind of catch on, really.
Yeah. Is it giving you an appreciation for some of that older stuff, reading this book? Or is it still like, oh,
sure.
That's, you know, it's probably best that that's just left as a historical curiosity?
Well, I, you know, yes to both of those, I guess. You know, he wrote a lot of stuff, and some of it sounds, you know, like, quote, pretty bad. Some of it seems like, oh, that's not too bad. And a lot of the stuff I'm talking about is poetry, because he mostly wrote poetry before.
Interesting. Okay.
Stuff, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a poetry expert. I can't really look at a poem, unless it's, like, egregiously bad or extremely good. I can't really judge the merits of a poem, you know. So it's all been interesting to see. I think if he hadn't spent a ton of time being a poet and writing the occasional story, you know, he wouldn't be the creative person that he was when he made that shift into writing weird fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's awesome that he did it. It doesn't seem like the stuff that should be in the textbooks of great classics, but, you know, yeah. At the same time, there's no reason why it wouldn't be enjoyable to read if you like the style of poetry. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So I did a poetry degree for my undergrad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's creative writing. So wrote a lot of poems. So I think I might be qualified to say if it's, you know, like, you know, readable or not. But at the same time, it's like, I mean, poetry's tough. I kind of feel like the experience of doing a degree in it gave me a good appreciation for it. And I think that more people should write poems and fewer people should be like professional poets.
Yeah.
If that makes
sense. Yeah. There's a playfulness about poetry that you can tap into, I think, that you can't always get in other mediums.
Yes.
Like, for example, Lovecraft was always exchanging like letters to the editor, arguing with other readers of these different magazines. So, I mean, huge numbers of letters, debating each other. And sometimes Lovecraft would, like, submit his argument in the form of a poem. It would be, like, a funny poem. And then sometimes the other person would, like, would take him up on it and reply. Their reply would be a poem.
That's amazing.
I don't know. There's a, it has given me a lot of appreciation. Lovecraft is someone... For all his faults, he was always creating. It wasn't always the same thing. Like, he went through phases where he was doing one thing and then he was doing others. But I'm sure you know a couple of people that no matter where they are in life, no matter what their life circumstances are, and no matter what kind of form of creativity they have open to them, they are always, their creativity is just overflowing. Mm-hmm. And I find that inspiring, even if the end product is quote, you know, not good,
yeah,
or And even if it comes from a really flawed person like Lovecraft, I think there's still something to be, you know, I don't think he could help it. So I don't know if admire is the right word exactly, but it be inspired by, I guess, is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, we've talked a lot about this before, and I think we even talked about it last time we were talking about Lovecraft. Like, it's okay to not be professional. Like, it's okay to not, like, make your money from something, right? Like, yeah. It's okay to, like, take stuff seriously. And I think that's really important. Like, yeah, for sure, take whatever you're doing very seriously, but it's also okay if it's, like, if it's not going to change the world at the same time, right? Like, yeah. A lot of the joy in creative work is the act of doing it, right? Like, you know, it's the same reason why we teach so many people how to, like, play piano when, yeah. like, there's not, you know, 10 billion spots for professional pianists, right? But it's like, it's useful and like worthwhile to do that.
Getting to know more creative people who do, I guess, what you might consider like kind of creative, like, I don't want to sound insulting here, kind of creative grunt work, like mm-hmm. writing a Star Wars,
yeah,
like tie-in novel or something like that. I have developed a great appreciation for people that can be handed like a writing or other creative assignment from a completely soulless corporation.
Yes.
And nonetheless, like pour their creativity and energy into it. I was mm-hmm. thinking one of my favorite authors is Jeff Vandermeer, who wrote Annihilation and a yeah. number of other books. And he wrote a Predator tie-in novel. And,
amazing. Yeah.
And you know, I don't know, that stuff like that makes me smile. I don't,
yeah,
but I don't want to derail us too much.
No, that's fine. We're fully derailed. Yeah, I have a friend of mine in town who is a writer, and she writes like cozy mysteries here and there. She does a lot of genre fiction.
Hey, that's cool.
Yeah, Sarah Zettel. You can look her up. She writes under a couple of pseudonyms, but she mentioned to me once that there was an author who got hired to write like a tie-in story for like a sugar company, right? It was like, yeah, and like, yes. I think, and she's even done some writing for like, there's a local tea company too that just like hired her to write a story in which yeah. like their tea was featured in it. And it's like, and it's on one hand, it's like, that is a ridiculous marketing stunt, but on the other hand, it's like, that's, I mean, why not, right? Like, yeah. you know, it can still be a good story, and like they happen to be drinking Arbor teas or whatever, right? So like, it's, yeah. But I mean, now, I think there's an openness, I think, to that in genre fiction that like literary people would like kind of snub their noses at. But at the yeah. same time, it's like if this makes it work such that like an artist can make something, like it's almost like patronage, right? It's like if they can totally. Make something that is interesting or fun or unique or like whatever it is, and it just also happens to have a recipe for like a baked good from Sara Lee in it, it's like, that's fine.
Yeah. yeah. You know, I veer between, well, I sometimes feel that I personally, I like, I'm too pretentious, like mm-hmm. when I think about the art and media I consume. And, you know, that means, you know, there are things that I enjoy that I will say are bad or kind of tell myself that's trash. Mm-hmm. And there are things I don't enjoy that, like, you know, have kind of a general aura of being, you know, that lots of other people would say is excellent. And the older I get, the less time, I guess, I want to waste, like, rating whether the stuff I'm doing mm. is meeting some sort of mm-hmm, mm-hmm. imaginary standard of pure art, yes. right? So yeah. if someone wrote a tea company tie-in novel and it was amazing, I want to celebrate that was an amazing, like, thing that they made and not sneer at it or, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah.
Also, do tea companies not, like, sponsor cozy mysteries? Because, oh my goodness, get on that right now.
I mean, they probably do. Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. Like, so cozy mysteries reminds me that I recently read Agatha Christie novel.
One?
Oh, I mean, I'm going to have to look it up because I cannot remember. It's like The Mystery on the Blue Train or The Murder on the Blue Train. There's a blue train. Murder on the Blue Train. I'm going to look it up real quick. Yeah, it's The Mystery of the Blue Train. So this is, I found out after the fact. So like we were chatting about this on Discord with some friends that this is like her least favorite novel that she ever wrote.
Oh, right.
She wrote it after, I think there was like a divorce and like a death and stuff yes. like that. And so it was yep. like very much like I just got to write this thing. Yeah, so I enjoyed it. I don't read a lot of mystery. Like, this is probably the first one that I've read in a decade or so, maybe longer than that. But yeah, I mean, it was good. I mean, like, I was fooled by it as well. Like, Perrault, like, that's his whole thing, right? He's much smarter than you. This one, I think in particular, there were some leaps in logic that there's just no way you could make, I think, from reading the novel. Or like, if you're making those leaps, you're making them at the exact same time that Perrault is, right? Like, but yeah, it was really entertaining. And I think, like, what struck me from it, and, like, I'm going to tie this back to gaming a little bit, is, like, I think when we think about, like, mysteries in tabletop games, they're often, like, really quick mysteries. Like, oh, there's a murder. Like, now we're locked in. We got to figure this thing out. Whereas Mystery of the Blue Train takes place, I think, over, like, a month or two, something like that. So there's, like, the murder, but then they kind of keep on going back to witnesses and, like, asking them stuff. And there's time that's passing between all of these events. And they have downtime where they're just, like, kind of hanging out and chatting and, like, traveling in other places. And there's, like, all this other, like, life stuff that happens in and amongst that. And it was really fascinating. And it's, like, I think part of it's just, like, the kind of slower pace of the story, too. But, yeah, I really enjoyed that. And that part really, like, stuck out to me. It's, like, yeah, thinking about, like, how you would do this in a game. Because I think in a game, the players would want to just sort of gather everybody up and question them all at once to try to figure it all out, you know, like, within an hour or two. But, like, yeah, Christy really gives, like, a lot of room for the people to kind of, like, get accused and then, you know, be, you know, exonerated and, like, going back and forth like that. So
did it feel poorly paced or scattered, or because that would be the negative version of what you're describing.
Yes, it felt a little bit like, I think the Christy is really good at writing characters, so it's, like, sort of fun, right? It's like, I mean, there's just, like, a hodgepodge of these, like, really fun NPCs to hang out, right? Like, didn't think about it in game terms. Like, so you don't, like, I don't think you're mad reading it. You're like, oh, well, this is, yeah. But you could also cut 30 pages out of it pretty easily and it would be the same story, or, like, have sort of the same impact. And I think she actually adapted it from a short story that she'd written as well too.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it was good. I'm glad I read it. Yeah. Just to kind of get a taste of mysteries again. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Glad to hear it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My reading has not included fiction in a while. So I have a number of nonfiction books going on. I'm reading a book about the Manson murders, and the connections, the all the crazy connections between that situation and, like, the CIA and the FBI and stuff like that. So it's we have over the decades we have learned a lot of stuff that is hard to fit into a narrative, but that is just interesting in itself, I guess. So,
Andy's pulling out a giant piece of, like, poster board, and it's got strings and stuff.
And it's funny. So this book is, I'm not really a true crime person, so I'm not, I don't actually really find the Manson murders interesting, but on a meta level, I find it interesting that there is an event that the Manson trial and stuff, this sequence of historical events that everyone was watching, that has been documented maybe more than anything except, like, World War II, you know, this massively documented, played out on live TV where you could watch it. And yet we still can't answer a lot of very basic questions about what happened and why. And to me, that's just interesting as a casual student of history. That you know, there, it's just crazy to me that we have something so documented that there are so many questions we can ask. And if you assume that that's the case about every historical fact that we assume happened as it was relayed to us, history is a crazy thing, I guess.
It is, yeah. I did not enjoy history classes in high school and, like, middle school and stuff like that. I took one in college that, like, started to give me a glimpse of that, of, like, history being sort of, like, the story that we tell about the past more than, like, dates and facts and stuff.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah. And I really wonder, like, how different my relationship would be to history if it had been presented a little bit more like that. Because, like, it's, like, it's one thing to know, like, I don't know, like, what year this war started. when you start drilling down into it, it's like, well, I mean, when did it actually start? Right. Like,
yeah.
Did it really start like 5 years before? Like, yeah, who decides like when it happened? Like, right. Like, yeah. There's just all these questions that sort of, yeah, start to swirl around. And like, even, I mean, just like the, like how history is taught in America too, with like this American exceptionalism and like, you know, like we're sort of the victors of everything. It's just like, I mean, that's just not, I don't know. Like it gets so complicated so quickly.
Yeah.
And like, that's really interesting. Like the complications are interesting.
You mentioned, you know, kind of storylines and narratives, and that this book is, I should say the name of the book. It's called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s. Like Tom, I can't see the last name. Tom, yeah. O'Neill, I think you can Google it, but you mentioned narratives, and you know, I think that's the point of this book, that we need a narrative. We have to have a story. It's just how we relate to things that have happened in the past. Mm-hmm. We like need to fit them into some kind of narrative. And so, but then that raises the very obvious question of like, who is telling the narrative, right? And mm-hmm. what are the other narratives that were discarded that might complicate the first, you know, we don't need to,
It's deeper in this, but. I know. Yeah. I'm reading Cloud Atlas right now, which that's like a whole nother discussion. Yes. But
that's very on topic.
Yeah, it is.
That is that narrative is a challenging one.
It's very challenging. Yeah. And you gave me some advice to just sort of like, don't get too bogged down in the details. Just like, you know, enjoy for what it is. But there's a character in it who is a journalist, and she writes for like a National Enquirer style paper.
Yeah.
And the editor of that at one point tells her pretty directly, I don't know the exact quote, but it's something along the lines of like, truth is whatever a bunch of people have decided on, or like what a bunch of people believe. Right. So like, go out there, and like, he's saying this in relation to like, just go write a story about anything, like, and you know, like make up the truth, and then we'll see if people believe it. Right. It's like, yeah, which is, I don't know, that's a challenging challenging thing to think about. But
it is, but I think we have finally found our segue into gaming, right?
Yes, like, yeah.
yes. Yeah, so, yeah, thanks for listening. This is Roll for Topic, where nothing is true, and there is no meaning.
Yes, yeah, but I mean,
reality
it is, like,
is what you input, what narrative you decide to impose on your
on your players. Yes. Yeah, well, I will for sure have more Cloud Atlas thoughts as I get into it, but it is it's a good one. I'm glad I'm reading it. It is, when I'm not reading it, I'm sort of thinking about it, which for me, that's always the hallmark of a good book, of like, yeah, like just trying to noodle, figuring it out, puzzling through things. So
well, I hope you enjoy it. I enjoyed it, and if you like it, you will also like other books by that author. Ask me in a couple of episodes for now. I just want to mention it because this does have my GM brain really going, is I am playing through the Mass Effect trilogy for the first time. I'm not done with it. I want to get through the whole trilogy because I want to see how the whole arc goes. But I've beaten the first one. I already have a lot of just GM brain things going on. So let's check in an episode or two.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I've got some Mass Effect thoughts too, although they're mostly negative. So
there's that too. But
yeah. let's talk about our topic at hand a little bit. I mean, I think, like, you know, so your personal Mount Rushmore of RPG creatives. I mean, I think it's probably pretty obvious if you listen to this podcast that like we enjoy like media and authors and like authorship and things like that. So like, yeah, for me, like I've got some answers to this. I think there's like sort of the obvious, like, you know, do you go back to like the beginning, quote unquote, the beginning? Like, do you just, you know, choose Gygax and is it Arneson? And like, you know, some of those luminaries of sort of like early tabletop gaming, or are there like, you know, some newer people like that too? So I don't know, Andy, do you have anyone that you're just like, yes, of course, this person is my, like, you know, top four, top five RPG creative?
I do. So my first answer is going to be pretty boring, or pretty much what you'd expect if you listen to us or Splatbook or connected to us in any way, you know, like Ken Haidt, is probably the RPG creator that has influenced me personally, my gaming, as well as just my general interests more than anyone else. Like I've gotten connected to so many things that I find fascinating through Ken Haidt specifically. So like Tim Powers, I discovered Tim Powers, a favorite author of mine, through Ken Haidt. And there's many other authors and other creative things out there that I discovered. So he goes on my Mount Rushmore. So
is that like from listening to like his podcast and stuff, or is that from like games that he's written? I guess
it is from, it is from all of the above. I used to read his live journal way back in the day.
Oh yeah.
And he did a very influential on me, column for Pyramid Magazine called Suppressed Transmissions.
Okay.
And it's every new column was just, here's a I'm oversimplifying it, but here's a weird thing in history. And here are some ways that you could, gamify this, you know, bring this into your game or, and so it basically, you know, Height would just do a sort of, you know, throw all of these connections, these like vaguely connected things out at you. And a lot of those leads I followed and found them to be really rewarding, mm-hmm. whether they were games or novels or movies. So anyway, so I don't want this just to be the praise Ken Height episode.
Yeah.
But by an order of magnitude, my life has been enriched by my exposure to the works of Ken Height. And even I like the games he does, but the things I've gotten the most out of his like blogging and game advice writing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I bet you some of those articles are probably pretty evergreen, right? Like
they're wonderful. I have behind me, there are two collected volumes published mm-hmm. by Steve Jackson Games. I imagine they're out of print, or maybe they're on print on demand now. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I still flip through them when I just need a little dose of like weird creativity.
That's super cool. Yeah, that's great. I mean, I know like, yeah, again, you mentioned Splatbook. John Corey loves Ken Height. I think in references him like almost every episode. But yeah, that's cool. I should give some of that a read. I think I've listened to, is it like Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff? There's a podcast with him and Robin Dula. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've listened to that a few times. And then did he write Dracula Dossier?
Am I remembering? Yes.
Okay, yeah. So mm-hmm. I started listening to an actual play of Dracula Dossier and like was loving that as well.
Great.
Yeah. So I mean that's like sort of his later work. So I'd love to go back and read some of that earlier stuff too.
Yeah. Beyond that, I'm going to turn the camera around on you in just a second. But beyond that, there's the big people who have made games I enjoy. So mm-hmm. Monty Cook and the other people at Monty Cook Games, I have, mm-hmm. they have brought a lot of gaming joy into my life through mm-hmm. mostly through the games that they publish.
Yeah.
There's other creators that, I like Robin Laws, a lot of his stuff has brought me joy in different ways. And, but I want to say, I won't be able to name a lot of names here, which seems like it might defeat the purpose. But one thing that's interesting when you're like me and you've been buying too many RPGs for decades of your life is that you start seeing the same like non-famous names mm-hmm. show up in the credits of games. And you start to notice, oh, this is a person who just like did a ton of like writing contributions for different White Wolf games.
Yeah.
And here's their name. Oh, they are writing their names in the credits of like a whole bunch of Star Trek RPG books, I don't think to myself, this person is, a hero of mine and I'm going to follow everything they do. But it's like a glimpse at like below that tier of like, everyone knows their name, Gygax mm-hmm. level inventors. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of creative people in this hobby that do great, like, work for money for a lot of games. And so I always, a whole lot of those people I first noticed in White Wolf books, which tended to have like big, rather long lists of like contributors. An awful lot of those names are still out there, and their names are in Star Trek. Their names are in whatever game, right? Every now and then they'll pop up in a D&D book or something like that as a credit,
So. Yeah.
Okay. So that's my pee on to like sort of the underappreciated like you know, working for a paycheck RPG writers out there.
Yeah, no, I think that is a really good call out. Yeah. Like, I mean, just as you're talking about that, I'm just thinking about, you know, there's probably, like, take 5th edition D&D, there's probably a couple names that are in, like, every book that you would never, you know, never pull out as, like, but I mean, it's like, how much have they shaped, like, this cultural juggernaut, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah, like, that's really cool work, and, right, so, yeah, you don't get, like, Gygax gets mentioned, or, you know, whatever, Chris Perkins or something like that. But, like, yeah, you don't get a mention, but, like, it's still really cool to have a hand in that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I just monologued for a very long time. Mm. So imagine me turning the camera away from me over to you and shoving the microphone in your face.
Yeah.
Who is on your Mount Rushmore? If I've said that mine has Ken Height and then, like, 45 unidentified people.
Yes. Yeah, so if you swing the camera around from Andy's Mount Rushmore, there's an opposing mountain dominant staring back at him, sea of faces. So the name that, like, immediately came to mind was Avery Alder for me. I think, like, I mean, I've gushed about The Quiet Year a ton. I think, like, The Quiet Year is just, like, such a brilliant work of, like, narrative game design. It's like something that I come back to a lot. It's something that I recommend to everybody. It's just like, it's one of those games where it's like, oh, you play D&D, have you played this, right? It's sort of like, for me, that's the nice, easy sort of on-ramp to, like, sort of like the I guess I would say, like, the other side of the hobby, which is not exactly the right term, but so Avery is definitely up there, and I haven't played any of her other games, and that's something that I really want to do too at some point, so she's for sure on there. And I think also for me, like, I really like the games that have, like, a really tight authorship. So you were mentioning, you know, games that are, like, kind of written by a bunch of people and stuff. Like, I kind of gravitate towards, like, these, in some ways, these, like, smaller games that, like, have kind of, like, a strong author to them too. So, like, John Harper comes to mind as well. So I played a few John Harper games, probably most notably Blades in the Dark. Just like that game system is just so good at getting out of the players, like, sort of what it wants. It's hard to run, you know, you can argue whether or not that book is well written. Like, I think there's some stuff to say there, but I mean, there's just, like, there's so many ideas and such, like, an interesting point of view that's going on with Blades in the Dark in particular. And I think just, like, Harper has a good grasp on that too, and trying to get that across. Yeah.
You can see, I have a really high regard for his work as well. And you can see, I always like it when, a game comes across to me as, like, this is how I, the author, want to play, like, to engage in this, like, hobby. You know, I remember this interview with, like, Monty Cook many years ago, or I don't know where I heard this, but when he designed Numenera after leaving a career defined by, like, his work on, like, third edition D&D and other really big stuff. And one of the pitches for Numenera that, like, really caught my mind was, like, I wanted to make a game that's, like, actually how I play at the mechanics represent how I actually play at the table. Right. Yeah. So this idea of, like, he's been writing D&D, but at his table, the game looks different. And so, when you read Numenera, you see his, like, what's important to him in a tabletop gaming experience. I get that vibe from John Harper as well, like, just in the mechanics that are in there. They evoke such a specific feel that, I don't know, you can see him, I don't know.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah, you can definitely see how the mechanics are supporting sort of, like, the feeling and what he wants at the table. What he wants the game to sort of give you at the table. I mean, it's cool too. Like, you know, it's like he has a publisher too, but I mean, I think it's like, you know, it's like John Harper presents Blades in the Dark, right? Like, I think that's really interesting. I mean, like, so you mentioned Monty Cook. He's definitely up there for me too. I think, like, you know, I do think, like, it is a little bit of a, I don't know, like, an easy one. I do think, like, for me, Gygax does have sort of, like, a place up there.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, right, there's questions about, like, how much credit he should be given and all that. But, like, I think there's something about, like, that sort of, like, I don't know. It's like Mount Rushmore too, right? Like, the same thing. Like, can you really give all these old crusty white dudes, like, as much credit as we give them? maybe not, right? But like, I mean, I think like Guy Gax is like, if there's one person that you're going to know about, like, yeah, you know, from RPGs, it's probably gonna be him, right? And like, I've read,
yeah,
like reading some of his, you know, his writing and like, you know, like advanced, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that. It's just like, there's something that is so unpolished about it that I really love. Like, you pick up a 5e book these days and it's very polished, and like that's the intent of it, yeah, too. But I mean, like, some of these older things are just sort of like, you know, he's sort of like making it up as he's going along, and like, people, yeah, are like asking him very specific questions about like, how do I handle whatever fall damage. He's like, I guess I gotta write a thing about about and fall damage and publish it somewhere, and like that becomes like gospel, right, for how many people. You know, like
you can see the game being built out of actual play, yes, right? Out of the needs and questions that come up at the table. Why are there rules for this and not for this other big topic? Because only one of those comes up at the table and you have to be ready to answer it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, think whatever you want about Gygax, but, you know, think about how many games, you know, how many games... obviously, plenty of games have built on Gygax's legacy, but he's important even when you're writing a game that's like pushing back against the type of game that he found fun. You know what I mean?
Or yeah.
That's like warping or transforming it in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I mean, I was always sort of wonder like what he like would have thought about like where the hobby has gone, right? Like, if he'd just be sort of like cantankerous and be like, well, there's, you know, my thing is the real thing and all this other stuff is it's junk, right? Or it's just like, yeah, poor imitation.
I think I can answer that for you. Okay. And the answer is cantankerous.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that was a bit of a leading question. But it's right, you kind of can't deny like, yeah, the contribution that he had.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And then my last one that I'm going to throw out, very similar to your sort of like unnamed masses, one,
yes,
is like actual play podcasts. I think like for me, like, I don't know, I guess I want a microphone up on my Mount Rushmore or something like that.
Oh yeah.
Like, it's just, it's such a different, like a different thing to have access to, right? Like, I don't know, like we just have access to audio of delightful human beings playing all sorts of games, you know, at your fingertips, right, your ears, you know, whatever you want them. And then in particular, like, I keep on thinking about, there's a podcast called Friends at the Table, which I know I've mentioned before. And I think without Friends at the Table, like, I don't know if Roll for Topic would exist.
Hmm.
And they're very different shows, right? Friends at the Table is a actual play podcast, super well produced. You know, they do a lot of like story-based games and things like that. But like, something about listening to that really like made podcasting kind of click for me or something, right? And like, I don't know, like, and I don't listen to them regularly anymore, but yeah, like, there's something about like the style of play that they do that I really enjoy. And I think like for that reason, right, there's Friends of the Table, whatever, you pick your one, Critical Role, whatever, like there's all these people doing these really interesting niche things within the space of RPGs, and like that to me is just like it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I'm that's a very appropriate thing to put on your Mount Rushmore these days. It's Okay, yeah. Well, any closing thoughts? We should probably wrap up.
No, this is a good one. I mean, I think my closing thought is always like, if people have thoughts about this, please let us know. I mean, I think this is a fascinating question. This one came from the Roll for Topic Discord. I can't remember who asked it, but it's a really good one. Like, yeah, just kind of thinking through that. I think it can be, you know, sometimes like tabletop games can be very like consumer and like consumption based activity, right? So it's always good, I think, to pause and sort of remember the people that are behind those things, so you're just not just like complaining about systems all the time. Like, you can think about like personality and who's behind it. So that's sort of my closing thought there.
Yeah, as I keep more names keep popping into my head here, and so I almost think maybe we should take a couple minutes in a future episode to like, I want to go down to the basement and write down the names of some of these people I'm talking about, you know, because where I recognize their name, like, oh, that guy.
Yeah.
So that's great. Maybe I'll list out a few of those in our next episode.
We should get some.
I sort of hate praising people, but not being able to put a name.
Yeah. To, you know what I mean? So, yeah. You should find a list of those names. I bet you we could get at least one of them on the podcast. I think that'd be fun.
you can gush
at them in person. All right. Well, I think that does it for us. Let's see, do some quick wrap up here. We are Roll for Topic. We're part of the Roll for It Media Podcasting Network. Our sister show, The Splat Book, with John Corey and Kyle Latino, can be found at thesplatbook.com. They recently had an episode on where they had JP, which is one of Kyle's collaborators. They're going to be doing a Star Wars? Yeah, Star Wars-based, like, Morkborg hack coming out pretty soon, which sounds really fun. So you can go listen to that episode with him. It's a really good episode. The second half of it, I really liked. It's kind of, like, very... very typical splat book where they get into something fairly deep. And cause Kyle and John and JP have like sort of like this deep knowledge of stuff. They can talk comics for ages, but then they talk about this theory or like not this theory. They talk about this, like, I don't know, this idea of like creating works within the RPG space and like, I don't know, like just getting into like everything that goes into that. Like, right. Like, if you want to make a zine, like the skills you have to have, right. Mm-hmm. And also just like kind of the joy of making those things too.
Yeah.
So it's a really good discussion. I don't want to preempt it too much, but like, yeah, go ahead and listen to that. It's a good podcast. Of course we love them over there.
Sounds good. I haven't listened to it yet. I don't know. I assume they are using Morkborg-ish rules to run something in Star Wars or Star Trek, Star Wars, but I do hope it, you know, everything is a flaming skeleton
with a
pentagram carved on its forehead.
Yeah. It's just Morkborg with those also lightsabers, I guess. Yeah. See,
that's a winning product right there. Okay.
No, you as a Star Wars lover, I think would enjoy their conversation because they talk about a little bit about like, well, how would you even do this? Right. And I think they have a very good approach to actually making that, interesting and some good theories about like why it actually makes a lot of sense versus people I think be like look at that and be like, well, I mean, but everybody's a Jedi, right? How would you do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have not been called a Star Wars lover in a while or forever. I do love Star Wars, but I think that love mostly consists of complaining about the prequels. I think that's the actual hobby and everything else is just kind of the icing on top.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, I think that does it for us. I've been Chris Salzman.
I've been Andy Rowe.
Remember, if your players are having fun, you're a great GM.